The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'm taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the fourth day of December already. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll talk to one of the best leadoff hitters and base runners in baseball history. Tim Rock Raines will join us. In the second half, we'll welcome in one of the dominant pitchers of his time, a hard-throwing southpaw. Sudden Sam McDowell will be here. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, while we're waiting for Tim Raines to join us, I was assured by his agent that he'd be giving us a call tonight. We're going to take a look at something that happened just this evening in the world of baseball. You might have caught it on the MLB Network. Two new men will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame this summer as part of the class of 2017. Former executive John Scherholz and also former commissioner of baseball, Commissioner Emeritus now. And that man's name is, I can't think of it now. Bud Selig. Oh, yes, Bud Selig, of course. Now, we're going to take a look at these two men. I'll give you a little rundown on their backgrounds. And while we're waiting for Tim Raines, we'll talk about John Scherholz, who he's the president of the Atlanta Braves of the National League. Before joining Atlanta, he spent 22 years with the Kansas City Royals organization, including nine from 1982 to 1990 as the club's general manager. Among the teams he's built are the 1985 Royals and the 1995 Braves, both World Series champions. His teams have also won their division 15 times. He was the general manager with the Atlanta Braves from 1990 to 2007. In 2007, he was promoted to the post of club president. He was born, John Scherholz was, in Baltimore, Maryland, a graduate of the Baltimore City College High School, Towson University, and Loyola University. While at Towson, Scherholz applied for Officer Candidate School and was rejected, as he was partially deaf. Before his career in baseball, Scherholz was a teacher at North Point Junior High in Baltimore, and upon leaving his teaching job, he was drafted by the United States Army to serve in the Vietnam War. After entering Major League Baseball with the Baltimore Orioles, Scherholz joined the United States Army Reserve. He's donated $250,000 to Towson in 1999. The money was used to upgrade the school's baseball facility, which was then named after John Scherholz. His son Jonathan was selected by Atlanta in the eighth round of the 2002 Major League Draft, and he played in the minor leagues until 2007. Jonathan retired from baseball in August 2007 to go back to Auburn University to complete his business degree. The younger Scherholz, who finished his six-year career in the minor leagues with a .223 batting average, was named manager of the Rome Braves, which is Atlanta's Class A minor league affiliate, in 2014. After the season, Jonathan was reassigned to the Braves front office to serve as an assistant player development director. Looking at the career of John Scherholz, the Baltimore Orioles hired him in 1966 as a result of a letter Scherholz sent to team owner Jeffrey Hofberger. Scherholz worked under Frank Cashin, Harry Dalton, and Lou Gorman, both big names in Major League front office history. In 1969, Major League Baseball expanded to Kansas City with the Royals. Gorman and Scherholz left for the Royals. Scherholz was named general manager of the Royals during the 1981 season and became Major League Baseball's youngest general manager at the time. Scherholz then built a strong relationship with Royals owner Ewing Kauffman, but left the team as it began to struggle. He joined the Braves in 1990, succeeding Bobby Cox, who returned to the dugout to manage the team. The duo of Scherholz and Cox produced an unprecedented run of success for the franchise, highlighted by the 1995 World Series championship. On October 11, 2007, Scherholz resigned as the Atlanta Braves general manager, but was promoted to club president, replacing Terry McGuirk. Scherholz's top assistant, Frank Wren, was named general manager at that point. Scherholz has sent many assistants to general manager positions around the league, including Wren and Braves' current GM, John Cappellello, Dayton Moore, the Braves' former director of scouting, and assistant GM under Scherholz, has been GM of the Kansas City Royals since 2006 when he replaced Allard Baird. In 2006, Scherholz published a book entitled Built to Win, which chronicled his tenure with the Braves and some of his most important moves as a GM. Included in his book is a trade the Braves almost made with the Pirates in 1992. Had the deal gone through, the Braves would have sent pitcher Alejandro Pena and outfielder Keith Mitchell to the Pirates in exchange for a guy by the name of Barry Bonds. That's the story of John Scherholz, tonight elected to baseball's Hall of Fame, class of 2017. I believe it's July 30th this year in Cooperstown will be the induction, and the players elected by the Baseball Writers Association of America in the class of 2017 will be announced on January 18th, 2017. We'll take a look now at the career of Alan Bud Selig, former commissioner, commissioner emeritus, if you will, of Major League Baseball. He currently serves as the commissioner emeritus of baseball, previously served as the ninth commissioner of baseball. He initially served the acting commissioner beginning in 1992 before being named the official commissioner in 1998. Selig oversaw baseball through the 1994 strike, the introduction of the wild card, interleague play, and the merging of the National and American Leagues under the office of the commissioner. He was instrumental in organizing the World Baseball Classic in 2006. Selig also introduced revenue sharing. He is credited for the financial turnaround of baseball during his tenure with a 400% increase in the revenue of MLB and annual record-breaking attendance. Selig enjoys a high level of support from baseball owners, which of course he was at one point a baseball owner. Jerome Holtzman, MLB's historian from 1999 until his death in 2008, believed Bud Selig to be the best commissioner in baseball history. During Selig's term of service, the use of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs became a public issue. The Mitchell Report, commissioned by Selig, concluded that the MLB commissioners, club officials, the Players Association, and all players all share to some extent in the responsibility for the steroid era. Following the release of the Mitchell Report, Congressman Cliff Stearns called publicly for Selig to step down as commissioner, citing his glacial response to the growing stain on baseball. Selig has pledged on numerous occasions to rid baseball of performance-enhancing drugs and has overseen many and instituted rule changes and penalties towards that end. Selig was previously, as we spoke of, the team owner and team president of the Milwaukee Brewers. As a Milwaukee native, he is credited for keeping baseball in Milwaukee. In 1970, he purchased the Seattle Pilots in bankruptcy court and renamed them the Milwaukee Brewers after the minor league team of the same name he had watched in his youth, which existed until the arrival of the Braves in Milwaukee in 1953. The Brewers went to the 1982 World Series and won 7 Organization of the Year awards during his tenure. Selig remains to this day a resident of the city of Milwaukee. On January 17, 2008, Selig's contract was extended through the 2012 season, after which he planned to retire, but he then decided to stay as commissioner until the end of the 2014 season, a move approved by the owners on January 12, 2012, which would take his leadership past his 80th birthday. Selig made $14.5 million in the 12-month period ending October 31, 2005. Selig announced on October 26, 2013 that he would retire in January of 15. On January 22, 2015, MLB announced that Selig would formally step down from the office when his current term expired on October 24, 2015. Bud Selig was born in Milwaukee and grew up in a Jewish family. His father, Ben Selig, had come to the United States from Romania with his family when he was 4 years old. Selig graduated from the University of Wisconsin at Madison with a BA in American History and Political Science in 1956. He served 2 years in the United States Army before working with his father, who owned a car leasing business in Milwaukee. Selig continues to be involved in the automotive industry, serving as president of the Selig Executive Lease Company. Selig's interest in baseball came from his mother. An immigrant from Ukraine, Marie Selig attended college, a rare accomplishment for a woman in the early 20th century, and became a school teacher. When Selig was only three, Marie began taking him and his older brother Jerry to Borchert Field, where the minor league Milwaukee Brewers played. When the Boston Braves relocated to Milwaukee in 1953, Selig switched allegiances and eventually became the team's largest public stockholder. Selig was devastated when he learned that the Braves were going to leave Milwaukee in favor of Atlanta. In 1965, when the Braves left Milwaukee, he divested his stock in the team. As a youngster, Selig's favorite player was Herschel Martin. As minority owner of the Milwaukee Brewers, Selig founded the organization Teams Incorporated in an attempt to prevent the majority owners, based out of Chicago, from moving the club to a larger television market. This was challenged legally on the basis that no prior team relocations in the modern era left the city without a team. Prior movements had all originated in cities which were home to at least two teams. When his quest to keep the team in Milwaukee finally failed after the 1965 season, he changed the group's name to Milwaukee Brewers Baseball Club Incorporated, after the minor league baseball team he grew up watching and devoted himself to, returning Major League Baseball to Milwaukee. Selig arranged for Major League games to be played at Milwaukee County Stadium. The first preseason matchup between the Chicago White Sox and the Minnesota Twins drew more than 51,000 spectators. Selig followed this up by hosting 9 White Sox regular season games in 1968 and 11 in 1969. One of the games played in Milwaukee that year was against the expansion Seattle Pilots, a team that would later become the Brewers. Those Milwaukee home games were phenomenally successful, with the handful of games accounting for about one-third of total White Sox home attendance. To satisfy that fan base, Selig decided to purchase the White Sox with the intention of moving them to Milwaukee in 1969. He entered into an agreement to buy the club, but the American League vetoed the sale, preferring to keep an American League team in Chicago, which at the time was still America's second-largest city. Selig turned his attention to other franchises. In 1970, he purchased the bankrupt Seattle Pilots franchise, moving them to his hometown and officially renaming the team the Brewers. During Selig's tenure as club president, the Brewers participated in postseason play in 1981, when the team finished first in the American League East during the second half of the season, and in 1982, when the team made it to the World Series, under the leadership of future Hall of Famers Robin Yount and Paul Molitor. Under Selig's watch, the Brewers also won 7 Organization of the Year awards, though they posted one of the worst winning percentages in the history of Major League Baseball over periods of 10 years or more. Selig was part of the owner's collusion in 1985 and 1987, resulting in the owners paying $280 million in damages to the players. Under his assumption of the commissioner's role, Selig transferred his ownership interest in the Brewers to his daughter, Wendy Selig Preeb, in order to remove any technical conflicts of interest, though it was widely presumed he maintained some hand in team operations. Although the team had been sold to Los Angeles investor Mark Anastasio, questions remain regarding Selig's past involvement. Selig's defenders point to the poor management of the team after the Selig Preeb took control of the team as proof that Selig was not working behind the scenes. Bud Selig was elected to the Wisconsin Athletic Hall of Fame in 2001, and on August 24, 2010, a statue of Selig, commissioned by Brewers owner Mark Anastasio and designed by artist Brian Mong, was unveiled outside Miller Park in Milwaukee. Taking a look at Bud Selig's career as acting commissioner, he became increasingly vocal opponent of then-commissioner Fay Vincent, who I consider to be the last true commissioner of baseball, and soon became the leader of a group seeking his removal. Selig has never stated that owners colluded, while Vincent has. The union basically, says Fay Vincent, the union basically doesn't trust the ownership because collusion was a $280 million theft by Selig and Jerry Reinsdorf of that money from the players. I mean, they rigged the signing of free agents. They got caught. They paid $280 million to the players, and I think that's polluted labor relations in baseball ever since it happened. I think the reason the Major League Baseball Players Association Executive Director Donald Fear has no trust in Selig. Following an 18-9 no-confidence vote, Vincent resigned. Selig had by this time become chairman of the Executive Council of Major League Baseball and as such became the de facto acting commissioner. His first major act was to institute the wild card and divisional playoff play, which has created much controversy amongst baseball fans. Those against the wild card see it as diminishing the importance of the pennant race and the regular season, with the true race often being for second rather than first place, while those in favor of it view it as an opportunity for teams to have a shot at the playoffs, even when they have no chance of a first-place finish in their division, thus maintaining fan interest later in the season. Selig suspended Cincinnati Reds owner Marge Schott for a year in 1993 for repeated racially insensitive and prejudicial comments and actions. The same year, New York Yankees owner George Steinbrenner was reinstated from a lifelong suspension that was instituted by Selig's predecessor Fay Vincent. Pete Rose has claimed that he applied for reinstatement over the years and received no such consideration. Rose, along with his close friend and former teammate Mike Schmidt, who is a strong supporter of Rose's reinstatement into baseball, met with Selig in 2002, where Rose privately admitted to Selig 2 years before going public with his admission about betting on baseball. Bud Selig was a close friend of the late Bart Giamatti, who was the commissioner when Rose was first banned from the sport in 1989. As acting commissioner, Selig represented MLB during the 1994 player strike and canceled the World Series that year, marking the first time the annual event had not been staged since 1904. As commissioner, after a six-year search for a new commissioner, the owners voted to give Selig the title on a permanent basis midway through the 1998 season. During his tenure, the game avoided a third work stoppage in 2002 and has seen the implementation of interleague play. Whereas in the past, the National and American Leagues had separate administrative organizations, which, for example, allowed for the introduction of different rules such as the designated hitter, under Selig, Major League Baseball consolidated the administrative functions of both leagues into the commissioner's office in 2000. The last official presidents of the NL and AL were Leonard Coleman and Gene Buttig, respectively. The reaction after September 11, 2001 of Major League Baseball, C-League ordered all baseball games postponed for a week because of the terror attacks on New York and Washington. The games were postponed not only out of respect and mourning for the victims, but also out of concern for the safety and security of the fans and players. After the conclusion of the 2001 World Series, C-League held a vote on contracting two teams, reportedly the Minnesota Twins and the Montreal Expos. This action led C-League, along with former Expos owner Jeffrey Loria, being sued for racketeering and conspiring with Loria to deliberately defraud the Expos minority owners. If found liable, the league could have been ordered to pay as much as $500 million in total damages. The judge also ruled that the Expos could not be moved or contracted unless the case was over. The case eventually went to arbitration and was settled out of court for an undisclosed sum. A week after C-League's announcement, Hennepin County Judge Harry Seymour Crump issued a temporary restraining order that forced the Twins to honor their lease and play the 2002 season at the Metrodome. In August 2002, the effort to contract the Twins officially fizzled as players and owners reached a consensus on a new labor agreement which extended the team's Metrodome lease. Another change during the tenure of Bud Selig as commissioner, changes to the MLB All-Star Game. In 2002, the All-Star Game played in Selig's hometown of Milwaukee. It was tied 7-7 after 9 innings and remained tied after the bottom of the 11th. Due to the recent managerial trend of granting playing time to as many available players as possible within the regulation 9 innings, both managers had used their entire roster. Concerned for the aims of the pitchers currently on the mound, C-League made the controversial decision to declare the game a tie, to the dissatisfaction of the Milwaukee fans. C-League said later that this call was embarrassing and that he was tremendously saddened by the outcome of the game. Since 2002, C-League subsequently tried to reinvigorate the All-Star Game by awarding the winning league home field advantage in the World Series. The 2003 All-Star Game had the same U.S. viewership as 2002, a 9.5 rating and a 17 share, and the ratings declined in 2002. The American television audience increased in 2006. On July 1, 2005, C-League suspended Texas Rangers pitcher Kenny Rogers for 20 games and fined him $50,000. Rogers got in trouble when on July 29, 2005, he purposely grabbed the camera of a cameraman, resulting in one camera falling to the ground. When the cameraman proceeded to pick up his camera, Rogers went back to him in an arguably threatening way. One of the reporters then resumed filming and Rogers knocked him down again. When an appeal of a suspension was pending, Rogers appeared at the 2005 All-Star Game in Detroit, where fans loudly booed him. On July 22, 2005, C-League heard Rogers' appeal of the suspension, and he decided to uphold the 20 games. However, an independent arbitrator ruled that C-League had exceeded his authority and reduced it to 13 games, but upheld the fine. Taking a look at the performance-enhancing drug issues during the C-League reign, if you will, C-League faced Congress on the issue of steroids after the congressional hearings in 2005. With the scrutiny of the sports and national media upon this issue, C-League put forth a proposal for stricter performance-enhancing drug testing to replace the current system. This proposal also included the banning of amphetamines, a first for Major League Baseball sports. The MLB Players Association and MLB reached an agreement in November on the new policy. C-League's testimony on the subject has been contradictory. In 2005, C-League told reporters, "I never even heard about them," steroids meaning, "until 1998 or 1999. I ran a team and nobody was closer to their players, and I never heard any comment from them. It wasn't until 1988 or 1999 that I heard the discussion." But a year later, testifying to Congress in 2006, C-League claimed personal credit for spotting the problem early. In 1994, before anybody was really talking about steroids in baseball, we proposed a program of testing for such substances to the Players Association. As early as 1998, I began formulating a strategic plan to eliminate the use of performance-enhancing substances from the game. During the 1988 ALCS, Oakland's Jose Canseco had been reportedly taunted by Boston fans with chants of steroids. Speaking at the 2013 All-Star Game, Seeley complained, "People say, well, you were slow to react." We were not slow to react. In fact, I heard this morning, and it aggravated me all over again. Good old Bud. By 2006, Seeley was forced to deal with the issue of steroid use. On March 30, 2006, a response to the controversy of the use of performance-enhancing drugs and the anticipated career home run record set by Barry Bonds, Seeley asked former U.S. Senator George Mitchell to lead an independent investigation into the use of steroids in baseball's recent past. Joe Sheehan from Baseball Prospectus wrote that the commission has been focusing blame for the era exclusively on uniform personnel and failing to investigate any role played by team ownership and management. Other areas affected by Bud Selig during his term as commissioner, the postseason schedule. Selig's decision to extend the traditional postseason schedule into November in an attempt to increase Nielsen ratings met with widespread disdain both inside and outside the baseball community. Other controversies is that involving Rob Dibble, criticizing his action for benefiting only the Milwaukee Brewers. Rob Dibble cites that the contradiction of the Twins would benefit the Brewers and they would, of the Twins would benefit the Brewers and they would potentially claim the Twins' share of the upper Midwest market. Terms of service, another area, made notable by Bud Selig. And, the Israel Baseball League, teaching in baseball, many other things that, we don't really have time to go into. We were hoping to have Tim Raines with us tonight. His, representative Randy Grossman assured me that he'd call in at 8 p.m. That hasn't been the case, so we've been reviewing the two new men elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame this evening by the Today's Era Committee, Braves General Manager and Team President John Scherholz, and former Commissioner of Baseball Bud Selig. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back with you in a moment with longtime southpaw in Major League Baseball, Sudden Sam McDowell. Stick around, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB in Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you tonight on this Sunday evening. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240. Jets play tomorrow night in Indianapolis. Get the Tums ready for that. The Giants-Steelers tonight. The Giants lose to the Pittsburgh Steelers. Yoenis Cespedes signs with the Mets this week. Matt Holliday just signed with the Yankees this evening. Two new Hall of Famers, John Scherholz and former Commissioner Bud Selig. We move ahead with my next guest. He played 15 seasons in Major League Baseball, the first 11 coming for the Cleveland Indians before a trade to the San Francisco Giants, followed by stints with the Yankees and the Pittsburgh Pirates. Six-time All-Star, AL ERA leader in 1965, five-time AL strikeout leader. I welcome into Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Sudden Sam McDowell. Sam, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Sam.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Now, you were born in Pittsburgh, PA. Who were some of your favorite teams and players back when you were a youngster?
Well, actually, to be quite frankly, I didn't have any favorites, primarily because I never saw a baseball game, a football game, a basketball game until I actually played in my first professional baseball game. We never had the money, growing up to go to any sports, event. Plus, myself and all my brothers and everything, we played football, basketball, baseball, cross country and tennis. And so therefore, we didn't have any time free.
Yeah, I guess not. Wow. That's some resume there.
I remember once in a while hearing on the radio, cause my dad would take it down in the cellar and he'd listen to it privately. And I'd hear the names like, Ralph Kiner, Wagner, High Trainer, but never really had any special ones until I guess, Dale Long broke the consecutive home run, hitting record of, 8 games in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, his name was bandied about everywhere after that, but I really can't say I had any heroes then.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, early in your career, Sam, you struggled with some control problems, flashes of brilliance there. Talk a little about your early career, control problems.
Well, basically in high school, I was a control pitcher and I had every pitch that you could imagine. In fact, what was interesting was when I got signed, before they sent me anywhere, which ultimately was D-ball, down in Lakeland, Florida, but mm-hmm. I was up in Cleveland for 3 or 4 days just so that the pitching coach up there, Mel Harder, could take a look to see what I should work on. And, at the time he said he's got all the pitches. There's no need working on any new ones. He's got 4 of the best I've ever seen. All he needs is some experience. Now, that was back when I was actually a control pitcher. But, however, in the maturity of, I guess, late of typical Irishman, I started to throw harder, faster and faster and faster, mm-hmm. the more that I pitched on a regular basis. And it wasn't until my second year or third year in professional ball that I started in having the ability to throw the ball by the hitters, which I hadn't had up to that point. And once I reached a point where I was firing the fastball like that, I basically, I'm going to say, got mentally lazy to the extent that knowing that I could throw the ball by people, I really didn't focus that much on control.
Okay.
And I just wanted to be able to throw harder and harder and harder. And so for my first 3, 4, 5 years in the major leagues, one of my problems was that I didn't have that much control. But also, my second problem was that I had no idea or concept how to pitch, not at the professional level. And, of course, every manager that I had up until that point would always tell me, don't worry about the science of pitching. You just pitch and do what I tell you. And so I had managers that were calling my pitches all the time. So I never knew why or where, but I just listened to them and kept getting my butt kicked at the major league level until finally in 1964 when I was sent back at spring training, which was my third year being sent back to the minor leagues. I finally told the general manager that enough was enough, that nobody was helping teaching me how to pitch. Everybody was calling my pitches and just telling me that they were going to make me a superstar by just listening to them.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what I was doing or how I was doing it. So it was about time that I found out one way or another. Was I going to make it or not?
So that 64 season, Sam, that was your breakout season. What made it your breakout season then? What did you finally do?
Well, I would say, when I was sent to the minor leagues, my manager then was Johnny Lippa.
Okay.
And the first day in spring training, he said, Sam, he says, I'm not a pitching coach, so I don't know how to help you. So he says, the only thing I will do is back you up. Whatever you think you need to try and do, let's do it. And that was the first step. The second step was I knew I had to be responsible for what I was doing. And so each game, I would have to say probably each pitch, I had an education. I was learning faster and faster and faster. And that did it for me because once I took total responsibility for everything I was doing, going through that learning process, I became a major league pitcher.
You did. Exactly. Now, 65 comes along. As we say, you're one of the elite pitchers in the league. All-star game. The first of six selections that would take place in your career. You pitched two innings in that 65 game. At the end of the year, Sudden Sam is at the top of several American League leader lists, including ERA, strikeouts, hits per nine innings. The strikeout total you had was the second highest in franchise history to a guy named Feller, which is not too shabby. 273 innings pitched, second to Mel Stottlemyer from the Yankees. What happened in 65 that put you over the top?
Well, I would say it was just a continuation of 1964.
Okay.
And that was really understanding what, where, when, and how. And then also I was fortunate they brought in a new manager, Alvin Dark.
Oh, yeah.
Who knew of my struggles, knew of what I went through, because everybody had told him, not in so many terms that Sam was having trouble like that. It was that, Sam wants to do things his way. And Alvin knew and understood what that meant. And so the bottom line was, he said, go ahead and do it. I'll help you. And he had brought in the pitching coach, Jack Sanford, who was the greatest help I ever had in my life next to my father.
Uh-huh.
And he would sit on the bench right next to me and we'd go over every hitter, what I did wrong, what I should have done, what I did right the previous inning, and then what was coming up, the next four hitters that I might face the coming inning. And it was just fantastic. That's what made me.
Excellent, yeah. Now, we're talking to Sam McDowell tonight on 1240 Sports Talk. You had a little dip in the following season, Sam. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I had a sore shoulder.
Okay.
I had torn a little bit of my rotator cuff, and it was quite painful. So I really had difficulty that year in trying to pitch, period.
You came back in 68. 68, for those folks who may not be aware, was called the year of the pitcher. The pitching mound was lowered, and pitchers really took off that year. That was the year Denny McClain won 31 games. You posted a career best 1.81 ERA, Sam, second to your teammate, who was another former guest of ours, Louis Tiant. What about 1968?
1968 is, again, just an improvement from what occurred in 1964, but I would have to say an accelerated rate, and everything was just coming along good. You couldn't ask for anything better.
No, that was a tremendous season. Now, 69, you go to the All-Star game again. You strike out four batters in two innings, including the Hall of Famer Roberto Clemente. Who was the toughest hitter you faced? Maybe either league, Sam. Who was the toughest guy for you?
Actually, Frank Howard.
Big Hondo. Yeah, okay.
He owned me. In fact, that was the reason why I played second base in the major leagues. A lot of people don't know it.
No, give us a story of that. Yeah.
I'm the last left-handed second baseman in the history of baseball. And I had a fielding average of 1,000.
Okay.
What had happened was that year in spring training, after Alvin Dark seeing the way Frank Howard owned me, he told me, he said, Sam, this year, he said, when we come up in with Washington, the Senators, and you're pitching in the seventh inning, we're winning by less than 3 runs. And Frank comes up in the game. He says, I'm going to bring another pitcher in, have him pitch to him, and then you can finish the game and come back in. He said, I'll put you in right field. I said, okay, no problem.
Okay.
And we got to a point where that's what happened. I walked a batter in the seventh inning, and I had 2 outs. And here comes Frank Howard, and I'm winning 1-0 at the time. And so our last hitter the previous inning was the second baseman, Larry Brown. So he told me, he said, Sam, you go to second base. And then he told all the infielders, look, we got 2 outs. Don't throw the ball to second base like you normally would for the third out. You make it go to first base because Sam's going to be playing second base. And so everybody, okay, fine. So they brought in Dean Chance, who owned Frank Howard.
Okay.
And Frank gets a two-hopper to shortstop, and just like normal natural reflexes, the shortstop at the time just grabbed the ball, flicked it, threw it to second base. Fortunately, I was there, making the third out of the inning. Then the following inning, I came back in, completed the game, and we won.
Outstanding. What a great story. I didn't know Dean Chance owned Hondo, huh?
Yep, he owned Hondo. Well, Dean owned quite a few players.
Yeah, he was a good one. He was a real good one. We saw him a little bit in the latter stages here with the Mets. Who did you have in your pocket?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure I could say there was any one particular one. I would have to say that most of your great home run hitters weren't that difficult for me because my pitch that I lived on was a high inside fastball.
Okay.
And a home run hitter for a high inside fastball, they can't get the bat around fast enough. And so I had fairly good success as long as I could keep it there.
Keep it
now,
up there, yeah.
It's very dangerous because you make one slight mistake. In fact, I remember basically a couple games I owned Mickey Mantle, and I basically, no matter what the score was or what the situation was, I was going to strike him out. But I had made a mistake, and I threw the ball low and away by accident, and he hit it in the upper deck in right field. Now, you can understand, he's a right-handed hitter at the time against me being left-handed.
Right.
And he hits a fastball of mine, which he couldn't get around on if it was up and in, but because it was low in the way, he could get around on it, which he did, and hit it in the upper deck in right field.
The Mick. Yeah, now, I want to ask you about what you think today's pitchers. In 1970, Sam, you threw a career-high 19 complete games. Now, most of these guys today don't have 19 complete games for a career. And that was second in the league to Cuellar. Now, what do you think of these guys built today going 5-6 at the most? What do you think of that?
Well, fortunately, I stayed in baseball, as you probably know. I was a counselor for the Texas Rangers and the Toronto Blue Jays.
Right.
For 18 years, and so I was able to see the difference and the change in the players. And basically, it's that the players train completely different today, where in the old days, a player like myself in grade school and high school, you'd play every single sport, you know, football, basketball, baseball, whatever they had. So you had a full conditioning program for your entire body. And of course, in order to be a good pitcher in baseball, you need that body to be totally in condition to work together as a machine.
Right.
Well, in this day and age, your coaches in high school, that don't understand that, they don't want your players playing any other sport except, the sport that he's coaching in. Which is a major misnomer, is thinking that, you know, it's going to be better, in the long run if they concentrate solely on, baseball.
Right.
Or if it's a football coach, strictly football and so on. They think it's better for you, which it's not. You may learn a little bit more than you expect, but at the same time, you're not as conditioned. Your complete body, you're conditioned primarily only in using that part of the body for that particular sport.
Okay.
And so you're not as strong, and that's why they were finding in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s and 90s, that your pitchers were having an awful lot more arm problems than ever before.
True.
And statistically, you were getting like, seven, injuries to every one that we had back in our day. And so that's why they started backing down from, pitching those long, games and using pitching counts.
I see.
Heck, if I had a pitch count that I had to stay within, I'd be out of the game in the third inning.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I remember one game in Detroit where I threw 243 pitches in a nine-inning game, and it was a shutout.
Wow.
And it was a hot day, too, in Detroit.
Unbelievable.
But you also remember, too, is that's when the specialists started to come around, like, you know, your Raleigh Fingers, like your Kent DeColvey, like your Sparky Lyle, and so on. These were specialists that you could really count on almost any time to do the job for you, but they were only going to come in and pitch one, two innings as a closer. And then later on, in the late 80s, you even started getting specialists, which were long relief people.
Right.
So, the game had completely changed.
It had, yeah. Now you have your setup men, your eighth inning guy, your ninth inning guy. The whole team is configured differently. Now you played with another guy who had a good arm in Rocky Colavito. Tell us a little bit about Rocky. There's a lot of fans of Rocky Colavito out there.
Well, Rocky, I saw the most phenomenal, you know, they always talk about Roberto Clemente.
Yeah.
Having the greatest arm and accuracy when he went into the corner in Ford Field in Pittsburgh, was able to get a ball and turn around without looking and fire a strike to third base when there was a runner on first base, and throwing out those runners repeatedly. Well, I saw the same thing happen with Rocky playing right field for us. That you couldn't believe. I mean, he had an arm that was unbelievable, And in fact, he could have made it as a great pitcher in the major leagues if he wanted to. In fact, you probably know he pitched quite a few games.
I remember him pitching for the Yankees, Sam. I remember him coming in.
And for Cleveland.
Yeah.
He came in a couple games for us as a long relief guy, and he pitched two or three innings. It was hitless and scoreless.
Great ball player, definitely, yeah. Now, how did it feel leaving Cleveland, Sam? We're talking to Sam McDowell tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You had a little trouble with your contract. Bowie Kuhn voided the contract because it contained what he claimed were illegal incentive clauses, and you had a little trouble when you left Cleveland, correct?
Yeah, that was considered the greatest secret that never was.
Yeah.
I won 20 games that year.
Right.
And that winter, we didn't add 2-, 3-, 4-, and 5-year contracts and so on. It was a basic contract in which you were not allowed to have any incentives, any clauses. It had to be the uniform contract. And with Cleveland, we had no money. And I kept trying to get a raise, which I thought was fair and equitable because I won 20 games.
Why not?
Even with a team that, you know, didn't hit very well. In fact, I was a pinch hitter for them. That tells you how bad they were. hitting, but when it got down to spring training, and I still hadn't signed yet, Alvin Dock said, if you get here, Sam, you're going to start opening day because we need the crowd. And he says, you're taking the chance on ruining your career if you're not in shape, which I agreed and I understood, but Jake Paul wasn't willing of giving away any money.
Right.
And he said, you come out here and I'll work on something. So I get out there with only 2 weeks left in spring training. And he says, Jake Paul tells me, here's a contract that if you, have the same years you had the year before, then you will be able to make $100,000 this year because I will pay you cash bonuses. And there was clauses in there like for how many people we average at a ball game that I pitched, how many strikeouts, how many walks, how many low hit games and so on. And there's like 10 clauses in there.
Right.
And so I said, okay, I'll take that. So I did sign with them. And I didn't have enough time to quite frankly in spring training because I had arm problems the whole season. But at one point, I actually had earned a $5,000 bonus, and I went to Gabe Ball and asked him for the $5,000. He said he was cash poor right then, but he said he'll have the money when we get back from New York. Now, when I signed the contract, he did say it was illegal, so nobody would know about it, and he would keep it in his safe in the office. And I said, okay. But all of a sudden, the minute I left his office, I get back to my hotel room, and there's a phone call from Bowie Kuhn. And gee whiz, Bowie Kuhn found out about the illegal contract.
Oh, man.
And, which I didn't know, there was two others, Nate Pinson and Greg Nettles, that also had clauses in their contract. Bowie says, I want to see all three of you in my office when you land here tomorrow to play the Yankee. So we went into his office, and he said that you guys have got to play for the basic contract that you signed for. And he threw out all the clauses, which means I won 20 games and never got a raise.
Definitely, yeah, I see that. Boy, oh, boy. Unbelievable. Now, you were traded. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say then, that's when I found out. Remember, we all quit?
Yeah.
And each one of us quit one for the first week, and then the second guy had to go back after 3 weeks because we just couldn't afford it, you know.
Right.
So anyhow, I had a meeting with Jay Paul and told him that I want to trade it. I want it out of there. I don't want to be anywhere near him. personally. I didn't care where he sent me, but I just didn't want to be around him.
Right.
And what was tragic was I loved the city. I had great friends there and made my family. We had it made there in Cleveland, but I just didn't want to be around him anymore, so he traded me to San Francisco. And then that's when my alcoholism really took over.
Oh, man, yeah.
And I just went wild from that point on.
Yeah, things kind of went down for you then. You were traded, for those folks who don't know, Sam was sent to the Giants for a guy by the name of Gaylord Perry, who comes in and wins a Cy Young Award in the next year for the Indians. Now, your days with the Yankees, Sam, did you, those were the beginning of the days for Steinbrenner, weren't they?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was the very first move that he ever made once he bought the Yankees. He bought me from the Giants because he remembered me from Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
And as you know, he lived in Cleveland at the time when he was from Cleveland.
Yeah, he was.
And I was the first guy that he made a deal on. He bought me from the Giants back to the Yankees and was in the process of starting to build to have a champion in 3, 4, 5 years, he said. But at that time, my alcoholism just got too much and just took over.
Now they say that the character of Sam Malone in Cheers is modeled after Sam McDowell. Tell us a little bit about that, Sam.
Yeah. Well, the actual writers were two ladies from Cleveland. And they wrote the script for Cheers. And, of course, that went on for many years, but my attorney I had gone to after it was so successful to see if I could get any money, and they said that it wouldn't work because they made just enough changes where they didn't have to pay me any royalties.
Yeah, right.
But I thought it was funny, except I thought that I treated women a lot better than Sam Malone.
Definitely, yeah. That sounds good. Now, Sam, we're running out of time. We'd love to have you back and talk some more baseball with us, if that's okay with you.
No problem at all. I enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us, and we wish you the best for the holiday season, Sam.
Thank you very much. Same with you, Bill.
We'll talk to you soon. Sam McDowell, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guest, Sam McDowell, and I'd not like to thank Tim Raines for not showing up. Right, Brian? Definitely, yes. Now, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you, thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday night, December 18th, so we'll look forward to that. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.